The message I have today, I think, is rather pointed. It may be a sharp point. So I'm going to talk about one of the books of the New Testament, and I see this book now in two parts. It's kind of an 85% and 15%. And I think the 85% is foundation. And it's the 15% that is going to change your life. Now, I don't want to disrespect the 85%. And some of you might be offended by me saying that the 85% is foundation, and that I'm recommending you concentrate on the 15%, but that's what I'm going to say. I think the 85% was mostly written for a different audience. I don't think it was really written for us. Yeah, we can get things out of it, but there's a difference. There are priorities in our lives, and one of the feelings that you get as you get older is that you don't have time for everything. And in my life, I don't have as much time for the 85% anymore. And I've got to look for the 15% that'll change my life. Now, what we're going to talk about is a mystery in the sense that there's no real clear picture as to who wrote this epistle. Okay, it's a little different in the sense that so many of the epistles in the New Testament say, "I, Paul, along with Silas, send you greetings." Right? It's obvious who's writing the letter. Barnabas and Paul, something like that. Paul and Timothy. It doesn't happen in this book. It just starts right off. The second thing is that biblical scholars, whatever that means, and I use that in a sense, it's the men that study Greek and stuff. They look at this epistle and they say, you know, this is not written in the same kind of Greek that Paul wrote in. I don't know if that's true or not. I have to accept, I certainly know nothing like they know as far as the literature, the Greek of it. So if they say it's different, okay, I'll take that. And the third point is that in the traditional sense, nobody in the early years of history about the epistles ever said or thought that Paul wrote this letter. To the contrary, they thought he did not write it, and even in the 300s, there was the historian or the writer Origen. He said, "God only knows who wrote this book." Now, to whom was it written? This is easier. All right, this was written to the Hebrews. Okay, and we call this epistle the Epistle to the Hebrews, and it's pretty clear that the expression, the author says, "our ancestors," and then he refers to the Old Testament. He refers to Moses and things like that. So the fact that it's to the Hebrews, I don't think there's any mystery about that. We don't know what city. Most cases, the letters were written to a city, to Rome, to Philippi, to Thessalonica, to Colossae. Not in this case. We don't know where it was written to. Was it written to Jerusalem? Perhaps. But there were also cities that had just as many Jews as Jerusalem. Alexandria was a good example. And then speaking of Alexandria, Maybe who came from Alexandria? Well, Apollos. Apollos came from Alexandria. So is it possible that Apollos wrote this letter? The lady I work with, she says, no, it was Barnabas. And Barnabas is an interesting connection because Barnabas was from Cyprus. Cyprus had a huge connection with Alexandria in a commercial and cultural sense. And if it were Barnabas, there's a connection there. So that's not bad. But I will tell you later what my conclusion is as to who wrote this. Now, it gets easier, the next point, and that's why was it written? This is pretty clear. You know that in that era of history, writing letters was not like it is today. Today, of course, writing letters is fading. We send emails now and we text. But in this case, and in the case of the New Testament, there was always a very good reason why they wrote a letter. It was not easy to either write the letter, the materials were expensive, and or you just didn't sit down and send somebody greetings. So this letter seems to have multiple significant reasons why it was written. I'm going to highlight three of them, three big reasons. And I want to say at this point that I firmly believe that the recipients of this letter were not happy to get this letter. I don't think this was particularly a feel-good letter. Like you say, you know, Philippians. We pick that as the pinnacle. That was a feel-good letter. And there are other letters where Paul expresses his love to the people, or the author does. In this case, this was a strong letter, and I think that many, many of the recipients were offended by it. The author here is really doing damage to some of their favorite thoughts. And see, that's this 85%. This is not a letter that's filled with compliments and praises. So I've highlighted three major issues. Number one, angels. Does that surprise you a little bit? Yeah, well, a little bit. Because, again, it's not an issue for us. We don't have a big issue with the angels. But I had no idea how enamored the Jews were with angels. Google angels and Jews and Jewish thought. You won't believe the tons of information on Jews and angels. They were obsessed. They loved angels. Everything was explained through angels. There was nothing that could happen that wasn't an angel. Weather, it's an angel. Agriculture, grows, doesn't grow, it's an angel. Good news, angel. Bad news, angel. Indigestion, angel. If you went to the rabbi and you said, Rabbi, I have a question for you. And if the rabbi can't explain it, you know what his answer was? Angels. So, what does the author do in this case? Well, he starts right off with this topic of angels, and he says, Jesus Christ is better than any angel. Do you realize how offensive that was to these people who just loved angels? And in the second chapter, The author continues and he says, remember, it was not to angels that God is going to give the next age. Oh, they don't like that either. So this was a strong message to something that was very dear to their heart. Oh, but we like angels. The author says, no, it doesn't matter that you like angels, that you like the stories of angels, that you believe in angels. Well, we do too. I still believe in angels. I believe we have guardian angels. But there is a priority. There is a position of Jesus Christ that far surpasses the angels. The second problem that the author addresses is the high priest. Well, here again, they loved the high priest. You know, they couldn't see Yahweh in their terminology, and they couldn't see Jesus anymore. But you know, the high priest was right over there in Jerusalem. And they knew right where he was. And the expression that comes to my mind is that he was kind of like their pope. He was the center of the church. He was the last word. They really liked the high priest. He dressed really well. He had quite a costume. He had gold on him. He had jewelry. He had a hat. Wow, this was really something. They just loved. He had the Urim and the Thummim. He could make decisions. And they thought he was pretty awesome. You know what this author says? Jesus Christ is the great high priest. How can you say that about our high priest? Jesus Christ is not even from the Levitical tribe. You see how hard it was for them to accept this? Jesus Christ is from Judah, not from the Levitical priesthood. Okay, the third issue. It's the temple. You know, the Jews didn't have a lot. They were suppressed. They were always being beat up, so to speak, and made to move and different things. But they had their temple in Jerusalem. This was one of the most outstanding buildings on the face of the earth. You know, the Romans were really into architecture. They built their Colosseum. They built Rome. Every city they went to, Philippi, Tarsus, they built monuments, but not many of them could even compare to the temple of the Jews in Jerusalem. And you're telling me to not worship my temple? You know, you have to hand it to them. They didn't have a lot of entertainment. And the temple was quite a show. The temple had music. They had trumpets, they had drums, they had tambourines, they had cymbals, they had parades, they had pageantry. If you liked blood and gore, that was there also, because they slaughtered animals. It was showtime. They loved, because it also had a little bit of religion worked into it. So they loved to go to the temple. They loved to talk about the temple, take their kids to the temple. You know that you could eat at the temple? The perimeter was filled with dining rooms. You bring your sacrifice, and then you go have dinner. You can't beat it. It's terrific. What did this author say? He said, no. He said, you, in your being, in your spiritual life, you're the new temple. Forget about the building in Jerusalem. So those are the three things that take virtually the first 11 chapters of Hebrews. The author is almost destroying their favorite things. They're icons. In chapter 1 and 2, it's the angels. Okay? And the author there says, the Son is higher than the angels. And to which of the angels did Jehovah ever say, Thou art my Son? That doesn't get much better than that. Chapters 3 through 8 are about the priesthood. And when he talks about the priesthood, he starts with Moses. Now, everybody likes Moses. I got a little statue of Moses on my desk at home. It's carved out of marble. You know, it's a little replica of Michelangelo's Moses in Rome. And on my dad's first trip to Italy, he brought that back for me. I have that in there. I love Moses. And the author here says, Moses did a good job, but it was all servant's work. Oh, my. Now, servant, that's not the best word translated. In that era, they didn't have servants. What did they have? They had slaves. So he's saying, the author is saying, that Moses did the work of a slave. And he said, in whose house was he? He said, who was the owner of the house? Who was the head of the house? It was Jesus Christ. Wow, you're taking Moses, the Jewish icon, and you're saying that he was a slave in the house of your Jesus Christ? Yeah, slightly offensive. At chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7, about the Levites, and as I said, you know, Jesus wasn't even from the Levites. And then he tells the story of Melchizedek. And he tells the story how Abraham, the other icon, and we heard that in the discourse just before this, how great Abraham was, how great David was, and still, as the brother said, we have this better position. That's what he's saying here. The Jewish tradition was Abraham is our father. And the author here says, guess what? Your father just paid tithes to Melchizedek. And Jesus Christ is of the order of Melchizedek. In chapters 9 and 10, he attacks the temple and the temple system. Part of the temple system were the sacrifices in the 9th chapter. And the author says here that all those sacrifices are gone. They're obsolete. And it was replaced by one sacrifice. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That was the final solution of sin. And he says that entire system back there, all of it, the temple, the tabernacle before it, the priesthood, the Moses, the Abraham, he said, you know what that was? He says that was just a hint. A hint of what is coming. And what came is Jesus Christ. Do you know how close a hint is? Did anybody ever come up to you in the days of your youth and give you a hint that they wanted to marry you? Was a hint enough? Did you go buy the wedding dress based on a hint? A hint is close to nothing. And he says, all those things, it's a hint compared to the reality of Jesus Christ. There's a translation in this from the 7th chapter in the 13th verse. It's a translation out of the translation, The Message. And The Message is free English nowadays. It's contemporary. And there are many times where it really touches my heart, like none other. The translation is called The Message. And the Message translates this as saying, in speaking of really of these whole 11 chapters, it says there is no way of understanding this. You can't understand any of this through the old Levitical priesthood. Those are strong words. I think they're true. So I wonder to myself frequently, why do we study the tents? Why do we study the curtains and the colors? And why do we study so much the Levitical priesthood? Verse 18 in chapter 7, the former ways of doing this system, a system of commandments that never worked the way it was supposed to, was set aside. My fear is that we spend too much time on the things that were set aside. I'm not saying we should never look at them, but what's the percentage? Chapter 10, verse 4, the plain fact is that bull and goat blood can't get rid of sin. It's only Jesus Christ. And as you look at this book, the writings, you see that he's working in Jesus Christ. Chapters 1 and 2, he says the Son is higher than the angels. Chapter 3, he says, verse 1, take a good hard look at Jesus. So he's working it in here. He says Jesus is the centerpiece of everything. Chapter 9, Jesus sacrificed himself once and for all, the final solution of sin. That's a quote from the Message. Chapter 8, verses 6, Jesus' priestly work far surpasses that which other priests do. That's the quote. He says, now that the veil has been rent, which was his body, we can walk right in. So is this a little offensive to you? What I've said about the first 11 chapters? Do you have trouble getting rid of the angels? Your worship of the angels? One of the things, the Jews love the angels so much. Do you know that they said there is a one individual angel for every blade of grass? That's what they believed. I don't think we have a problem with angels. I don't think we have a problem with the Jewish high priest. I don't think we have a problem worshiping the temple. And that's 85% of this book. With no disrespect to the 85%. Spend a little bit of time on it. But don't spend all your time on it. Because there's another 15%. So what happens next? The next thing that happens is the word therefore. Therefore. You know what therefore means? That means I've built something, a case, ideas, reasons, principles, rules. I built all that stuff. Now, therefore, go do something. So you've got 11 chapters, and then he says, therefore. Now, what's kind of interesting to me is, you remember the parallel with Romans? Well, this is almost identical. It's almost like a little miracle. Romans, circumcision, the law is finished. Abraham's circumcision. Now, circumcision is the heart. It's not the Jewish circumcision. In the fifth chapter, the atonement. Sixth chapter, how we fight things and we have to bury them. Seventh chapter, the deadly sins. It goes on. And Paul builds that all up in Romans, and he gets finished with the 11th chapter. And what's he say in 12:1? Therefore, I've given you all these rules and all these principles, all this logic. Therefore, present your bodies a living sacrifice. That's what he says in Romans. This is the same thing. Very interesting. 11 chapters. Background, foundation. 12:1, he says, therefore. Therefore what? Second verse. Keep your eyes on Jesus. This is the 15%. But in our lives, I think it's got to be the 85%. In verse 2, he says, and this is why I love the Message Bible. Let me see if I have it here. Yeah. He says, study how he did it. Isn't that terrific? Keep your eyes on Jesus and study how he did it. I think that's what we have to do. We have to study Jesus. You know what that means? Pretty much it means studying the four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Those are the record that God has deemed that we have. We've got his words, we've got his parables, we've got his proverbs, we have his miracles, we have how he dealt with things, we have his reactions. Verse 3 says, because you almost said in your mind, you said, yeah, I've done that. I've done that, and I did it a lot in Sunday school. We did all that in Sunday school. Verse 3, the author knew you were going to say that. He says, go over the story again. That's pretty cute, isn't it? Go over the story again, item by item. Friends, you cannot get enough of Jesus Christ. Now, one of the best memories I am going to have of this convention is I was sitting up here and you sang number 8. And I had the privilege of seeing you sing it. And I could see the passion in you when you were saying, all for Jesus, all for Jesus. And I loved it. I hope I never forget that view. I'm going to tell you a little aside. This is just between us. I'm glad it's not being broadcast over the world. I did a survey, a particular time period of 20 discourses in our fellowship. Okay, 20 discourses. No, I'm sorry. It's 30. It was 30. 30 discourses in a well-accepted convention, a collection. 3 of them were on Jesus. You get it? 30 discourses and 3 of them were on Jesus. Now, doggone it, is that the right percentage? I don't think so. What do we study in our studies? What do we study? What are the discourses we hear? And I'm just talking percentages. I'm not saying never talk about those other things. But I don't think the percentages are high enough. The Apostle Paul had a style. And in most of his letters, he repeats it. And he starts out with a problem. And then he discusses the problem. And then at the end of the letter, he tells you what to do. I kind of call it a to-do list. If you look at the book of Romans, there's 11 chapters background. He says, therefore, and then chapters 12, 13, 14, he tells you what to do. Does the same thing in Thessalonians. There's problems there about second presence and all this. And then he gets to the end and he tells you what to do. He gives you a to-do list. He does the same thing in Ephesians. The first 3 chapters are about history and et cetera, et cetera. And then the last 3 chapters are a to-do list. I encourage you to read these books and pull out the to-do list and you'll know exactly what to do with your consecrated life. So he does the, I said he does, see, I slipped there, didn't I? I didn't say the author. I said he does. Yeah, I think Paul wrote this letter. Because the style's the same. He's got the 11 chapters, and then he goes, and he's got the to-do list. It's just the same as all his other letters. As far as these Greek scholars that say, well, it's different kind of Greek, I think maybe he had somebody writing it for him. And maybe somebody wrote it down in different Greek than Paul would write. But this has got Paul's fingerprints all over it. And, you know, if someday I find out and I'm face to face with Barnabas or Apollos and they say to me, you know, I wrote that letter, I'm going to say, well, forgive me, but you learned well from the Apostle Paul. So here, chapters 12 and 13 are the action items. So I went through 12 and 13. And I pulled out do's and don'ts. This is what you should do for your consecration. Don't do this. I'll show you my list. But I really would rather you get your own list. 12 and 13. You've already read 1 through 11 many times. Sit down with a readable translation and pick out all the things you're supposed to do. So, first of all, for our consecration, keep your eyes on Jesus, study how he did it. And so in 13:13, and I've kind of shuffled them around now so that there's just four on consecration. He said, we have to witness. Okay, that's in 13:13. You know that one. Go without the camp, like Jesus did. Go outside. And the thing I always like to say here is the quotation that we as Christians, followers of Christ, should witness every day and sometimes even use words. Okay? So I'm not talking about going out and talking to your friends every day that you are the called class, that you are the 144,000, and that you're going to have immortality. And incidentally, there will be a kingdom for you here on earth. But I'm not talking about that kind of witnessing. I'm talking about living a life of Christ that people can see the difference. Then once in a while you can use words. Okay, 13 chapter, verse 18, prayer. Very important part of our Christian consecration. 12th chapter, 28th verse, be thankful. The next section is more our relationship with others. So in 12:14, he says you have to get along with each other. All right, that's pretty basic. 12:15, generosity. I can testify that this group here, the local group, the Vernon Ecclesia, has been generous. They've been generous to me personally, and they've showed us hospitality. They've fed us. They greeted us. They embraced us. That's what this is talking about. Empathy means to feel for other people. You know, you have to do more. This is in 13:3. You have to do more than just say, oh, the kingdom's going to help you. You got to help people now. Honor your spouse, 13:4. And I think this is huge. This one's huge. Because the real test of your Christianity and your Christ-likeness is not outside on the street so much. A little bit. How about when you're driving? It's a little bit. How about at work? That's a little bit more. You show your Christianity. Where do you really show your Christianity? At home with your spouse. All the facade is gone. That's who you really are. Honor the pastors. We heard this earlier today. Very good. 13:7 and 17. Honor the elders. Acknowledge them. When's the last time you told an elder, that was a good study? I appreciate the effort that you put into preparing for that study. Acknowledge them. We are so afraid of their head getting too big. No, the apostle here says, honor your leaders. Then the last group I have are the do-nots. As I picked out from chapters, which two chapters? Tell me. 12 and 13. Okay. So don't pity yourself because of your trials. Don't be discontent. Don't get into materialism. And I like this last one a lot. 13 chapter 9th verse. Don't get into speculation. I announced at the PA convention that I have a new invention. And my new invention is called a speculation meter. And it has a green light, a yellow light, and a red light. And it's to be, I'm going to produce these, and I already got some orders for it. It's going to be computerized. And what you do with it is you have the platform here. The podium always goes in the middle with the crossing crown. That's very important. We usually have a divine plan of the ages. That should go on the right-hand side. And on the left-hand side is my speculation meter. And if the speaking is coming only from the scriptures, the green light is on. But if it starts to wander off the scriptures, the yellow light comes on. And if the brother is just making up stuff, the red light's on. So I'm encouraging you to use that speculation meter every discourse you hear and every study you're in and say, is this coming straight from the Word of God? Is this coming from Jesus Christ? Or are we now off on the trail of speculation? Here, I've got a scripture, 13:9, Hebrews, don't speculate. He closes by saying, get rid of every weight. Those are the things that we don't need, that are holding us down. Run with endurance and keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. So that's my story. That's my burden. And I hope that, as the author once said, that you can take the grains of wheat and then blow away the chaff with a breath of kindness and love. And I hope you can keep the kernel of how important it is to focus on our Lord and Master, all for Jesus. Thank you.